I'd like to thank your congregation for inviting me here to share my work on Portland's Climate Action Plan and also my personal journey towards climate protection. I arrived in 1994 into Portland and attended the Unitarian Universalist Church downtown. At that time, there was a new reverend there, Dr. Marilyn Sewell, who I'm sure most of you have at least heard of, not didn't know personally. And she was very inspiring at that time to provide some spirit guidance and direction. At the time, I was 24 years old, arriving into a new city. It's an honor to be back here at the Media Church for Light's congregation here today to share the story. So let me rewind a few years earlier to 1990. That was a big year in terms of climate responsibility as the whole world. That was the year that the United Nations gathered many countries, especially all the industrialized countries, together in Rio de Janeiro, and came up with the first framework on the environment. And climate change is a big part of that. At that time, I was studying at the University of California in Santa Barbara. I was studying chemical engineering and steered that direction by a computer in high school, the only computer we had in high school, actually. I told you which career to go for based on your grades. Apparently, I did well in chemistry and math, so I told my mother, who's Vietnamese, and said, great, that'll make lots of money. And it was actually the highest paid four-year degree on average. As it turns out, though, I realized, if you work for the fossil fuel industry. So here I am studying along, and 2 years in, and I need to take an elective course in engineering. There's very few elective courses, but I took a meteorology course and realized that there is this theory of global warming developing that I had never heard of before. And I was a little shocked by it. And really, there was this theory that was causing, the human cause of global warming that was developing within the scientific community. And by theory, I mean a 90% certainty that this was happening, even back then. And so I, a little reflection, what does that mean in terms of our life experience? So in Portland, the forecast for climate change in our future is hotter, drier summers and more intense precipitation events in winter. And we can see that just in the last year. Even though this is an El Nino year, we've had previous El Nino years, and we've set records that by far exceed what they were in the past. For instance, this last summer, everybody remembers how hot it was, right? It didn't get super hot, like over 100 degrees, but we had 29 days that were above 90 degrees. The old record is 24. So that we blew that record out of the water. Now we're kind of suffering through the winter part, right? So the intense rain events. In December, TBS had a 24-hour rainfall event that was also set a record, the most in 24 hours. And then overall, even though February is not over, we are now already setting the record this year for winter months of most precipitation in Portland. So we still have, apparently today, to add on to that in the next couple weeks until we reach the end of February, or a week and a half. So this is the type of change that is now being, we can see across the world. It affects everyone. If there's a social justice issue in here too, because the impacts of climate change, although I might complain about the rain and maybe it's getting too hot in summer, the impacts of climate change are not equitably distributed, and the effects can be much greater in other parts of the world. As mentioned, I'm half Vietnamese, and I had the pleasure of going back to Vietnam to do eco-district work in 2011. I went to this small town called Hoi An. It's a brand center in Vietnam on the coast. So a city that's been there for thousands of years was established as a port city by the Chinese a long time ago. It was actually a Chinese city, and then it became a Japanese city, now it's a Vietnamese city. It's not big, though. It was established as a port when boats were very small. Now there's a much larger port north of there, so it's kind of this ancient city, and the inner part of it still has this ancient character. It's not a world UNESCO site, actually. So when you go to the center of the town, you can see the old way of how they would handle a major issue in that area was flooding. So these floods would come through, and they would expect it as the monsoons came, and the houses are two stories. And separating the first and second story is a hole in the middle of the ceiling. And so what they would do when the floods came, they would design the bottom of the house to withstand the flood, and they would pull their furniture out to the second floor, all their belongings, and wait for the flood to pass and then bring it back down. Their challenge, though, in the last 20 years, increasingly, is that that strategy no longer works. This strategy that's worked for thousands of years no longer works for them. Problem is, the floods are getting us their second level. And also, they're lasting longer, where they can't withstand the length the amount of days it requires for them to be at this other level, too. So this is a huge challenge for them, and it's really about relocation. And this is very important to the Vietnamese culture, too, because in this culture, the ancestors and the worship of those ancestors belongs in that house. So to move to another place is to leave your ancestral history behind, which is where much of the spiritual guidance that's part of the culture exists. So this is a huge impact on the people of Vietnam. They're also one of the poorest countries in the world and have the least resources to figure out what to do next to prevent or even mitigate the impacts. So going back to 1990, I had no idea what the impacts of climate change were going to be. But at the same time, I felt this existential conflict of what should I do with my career path? And so I decided to go into environmental engineering instead and started transforming my career in that direction. When I finished school, I went into environmental consulting, which happens to be the lowest paid trajectory that you can have with a four-year chemical engineering degree. I had to kind of suck it up and say, all right, that's all right. I'm going to try to do the right thing. I targeted air quality engineering in Portland with a local firm called CH Hill. It was very well respected. The reason why I focused on air quality engineering because there was this new version of the Clean Air Act. And I thought that this would get to global warming eventually. And we had a champion politically in our country. This was 20 years ago with Al Gore. But by the end of the 1990s, it became very apparent that we were not going to do anything as a nation. The Kyoto Protocol came and went in 1997, and I really started giving up hope. And the work that I was doing was being focused elsewhere, outside of air quality, and so if I wanted to continue my career, I'd have to work on noise pollution. Actually, I don't have a problem with noise. Some of the music I listen to is kind of noisy. So this has become the most meaningless career when I wanted it to be meaningful. So now what? And my wife is here, Jill. We decided that maybe we just need a big break from society. And so we bought the company Sanford Van off of an auction. And back then, gas was less than $1 a gallon. And we drove around for a year in the U.S. and Mexico and Canada, kind of on a spiritual journey, really. I didn't plan it that way, but it turned out to be that way right from the start. And during that time, I found some spiritual purpose about what is it that I can do? There's so much that I can't do because of the politics of the situation. But what I can do, I came back to start teaching. So I went to teach at two colleges to non-science majors that I felt were receiving conflicting messages about what's the cause of climate change. And really, by then, it has evolved from global warming into climate change. It's really about destabilization of climate. So I did that for about 7 years, and traditionally professors after 7 years will take a year off and do a sabbatical year and get inspired to continue to teach for another 7 years. So in that time, I started working with the city of Portland, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, then with the Office of Sustainable Development, and I was hired on essentially to work for 1 year on a green building policy. And this would be a game-changing policy to focus on commercial and residential buildings. Commercial buildings, for instance, well, combined together, commercial and residential are over almost half of our emissions, but more than transportation emissions. So often we think that global warming has been caused by our vehicles. Well, in Portland, we do a lot to not get into our vehicles. So now it's really about our buildings. So we thought we'd do this in 1 year. Here I am 8 years later, and we just passed one quarter of that policy on Earth Day of 2015. But for me, that's a turning point. I'll be talking about that later, about this landmark here that we get that done. This will help us reach our goals. Our goal is 40% reduction in emissions relative to 1990 carbon emissions by 2030. And we're internationally known for the work that we've done because we've had a 14% reduction relative to 1990. And that's actually in line with the Kyoto targets. So even though our nation rejected the protocol, this international agreement, the city of Portland moved forward with those goals and succeeded. So a lot of that success is on the residential and transportation sectors, not so much on commercial buildings. And our policy really focused on commercial buildings. And it's pretty simple. It's that we take the energy that's used, and bigger buildings actually 20,000 square feet on us, not one this size, but definitely like the library across the street is probably very close to that. And so the largest buildings cover 80% of the square feet in Portland, and we require them to gather all their energy information to a common metric, like miles per gallon for vehicles, and then to make that publicly available. So that people can make an apples-to-apples comparison if they're buying that property or if they're choosing to be tenants. So it's basically adding into our market decisions the energy information. There's also some contextual opportunity to share a narrative in there about what do those numbers mean. And we make it all publicly available on that and start driving people towards using that information. We're the 13th city to do so. When I started in 2007, we were going to be the first city. So now I can say that it's great to see this ripple of ideas that happened with Seattle and San Francisco and Austin and Portland back in 2007. We all kind of joined together and started scoping out what does this look like. There's actually 15 cities all together. So it's exciting to finally get into this area because commercial buildings are an area that has been stuck at 1990 levels. For residential buildings, we've actually had quite a few improvements since 1990. And this is considering the population growth, too. So population has increased by 30%, but we've reduced our emissions by over 10%. And that's much because of our individual choices. And so, for instance, you know, of course, all of us here are aware of this issue, and we have to make these decisions as we go through our day. And this morning, should we ride our bikes or drive? We don't live that far away. We're 30th and 18th, about a mile and a half away. And still, it's kind of this conflicted decision, you know, because we see the weather forecast is pouring rain. It's not warm out. Should we drive? Well, it wasn't raining when we left. We can change clothes or down. So we ended up riding our bikes over. Some of them were the decision-making on an individual level. We're starting to get more conflicted about because we need to make this jump from the 14% reduction to the 40% reduction. What will take us there? And really, all the low-hanging fruit has been picked, and now we're getting out to major decisions. So when I look at my own carbon footprint, the latest thing we're looking at is an annual decision of whether or not to go to a tropical place in winter, because it is raining here, and it's getting more intense in the rain. And this year, we decided to go again. The challenge in there is that our family carbon footprint, just from flying to Mexico and back one time per year to go out of town, is almost equivalent to our entire emissions for the whole year because we reduce these other emissions. So when we get to that really deep level, we have to really put this on the table and start thinking about, if not this year, then when? And that's the type of, I think, individual decision making that we've seen by a lot of people in Portland that has resulted in improvements in our carbon emissions, whether they're small or large. And Nate, I want to cover a few scales because really the story is about Portland, how Portland's been a leader. And the scale of change in neighborhoods is very great. Through programs like Solarize, this is an SCD program. It's really neighborhoods got together and said, hey, if we buy in bulk with solar, can we get a better discount? And it turns out to get a really great discount by buying as a neighborhood instead of individuals. And I'm sure some of you either heard of this or have this on your own house list right now. So that resulted in about 3,000 installations over the course of 5 years. And the city just kind of provided technical advice along the way. This was really action by neighborhoods. That was up from about 100 systems prior to that. It's a huge amount of growth because of the neighborhood organization. Of course, as a city, we have a climate action plan dimensions. It's international right now. And it covers many different areas, transportation, buildings being at the center of it, but also solid waste and recycling, composting. That our whole composting program came out of the Climate Action Plan. There's a lot of decision-making around choices, around products, and food choices now that we're focused on planting trees, walking the talk with our own city government. So we're doing quite a bit through this Climate Action Plan. At the state level, we have a clean energy bill that looks very likely to pass through the legislature because it's a collaborative effort between nonprofit organizations that are advocating for clean energy and climate protection, and also the utilities. And it's the first time I've ever seen anything like this where the utilities and the nonprofits are working together and said, hey, we can come up with a new renewable portfolio standard that takes us to 2040 that's in line with the city's climate action plan, too. So this is to transform our electricity from being mostly coal and natural gas-based to mostly renewable energy-based. Between hydropower, winds, and solar. This has not happened since industrialization in Oregon. So I think this, it's very exciting that this is looking likely to pass through our legislature. At a national level, there's one statistic from 2015 that I think speaks volumes, and that is that our economic growth has decoupled from our carbon emission growth. So in 2015, we saw our carbon emissions start to go down while our economy is growing. And this is the whole concept of growing clean energy economy that we started to see through leadership like the Obama administration and others at the national level. So this is a, I actually never thought that this would happen. So this really speaks hope to me. Worldwide, there's an understanding now that fossil fuels have lost the race against renewables. So the amount of new capacity for solar and wind now exceeds the amount of capacity that's being added from coal and natural gas. This is really big. Worldwide, renewable energy, not including hydropower, is about 1%. So suddenly the tables have turned, so we're seeing the growth of that 1% exceed the growth of the fossil fuel contribution to electricity. So it's no longer a question of can this happen, but when will it happen? And that this is essentially the beginning to an end of fossil fuels. So that's the message that I wanted to share today, is that this last year especially has been a turning point. And more so than ever, I feel that there is hope that we will have a stable climate. And the question is really, when will it become stable, not if we can do that. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to be able to share that message here today. As an honor to be here.